Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. Come spend the Sabbath with us. We meet at 828 3rd Street in beautiful Hudson, Wisconsin, only 25 minutes from downtown St. Paul. For more information, click on Services and Location at BethEmmanuel.org.
As the Lamb begins to break the seals in order to open the scroll with seven seals and read the text of the final redemption, and each seal is going to trigger a new calamity or new tribulation on the earth. In fact, the first four seals will signal, tonight we'll see, the first four seals that are broken will signal four riders to ride out from heaven and wreak havoc upon the earth. And the four riders are, of course, the infamous four horsemen of the apocalypse. And this, the four horsemen of the apocalypse riding forth, is the beginning of the depiction of the woes that will descend upon the earth and upon human beings, which constitutes so much of the ensuing material in the book of Revelation. This is really where we're just, you know, we're getting warmed up here in the sixth chapter of the book of Revelation. Before we get into this material, we want to understand what's going on from the broader perspective of Jewish apocalypse just for a moment. Remember that an apocalypse, an unveiling, grants us a glimpse into the future when God will directly intervene in human affairs to right injustice and to avenge his people. And so in Jewish apocalyptic literature, for example, we find a frequent motif predicting 7 years of cataclysm and natural disaster and earthquake and conflagrations and plagues and pestilences and famines and persecutions and wars and rumors of war and that sort of thing. The Talmud predicts a 7-year period of tribulation which will commence with the troubles on earth and culminate with the establishment of the kingdom and the coming of the Messiah. So, for example, it says in Sanhedrin 97a, in the 7 years of the Son of David's coming, in the first year, the verse that says, I would send rain on one city, and on another city I would not send rain, will be fulfilled. In the second year, the arrows of hunger will be sent forth. In the third year, a great famine during which men, women, infants, the devout, and men of deeds will die, and the Torah will be forgotten by her students. In the fourth year, there will be plenty, yet no plenty. In the fifth, great plenty, when men will eat and drink and rejoice, and the Torah will return to its disciples. And in the sixth year, sounds from heaven. And in the seventh year, at the end of 7 years, the Son of David will come. This is an example. This is just an example. The main point here is that there is a general expectation that before the coming of Messiah, there will be a series of troubles. Jewish sources sometimes refer to these troubles as the birth pangs of Messiah, or in some cases as the footsteps of Messiah. This is the kind of thing that we are going to be seeing playing out as the seals on the scroll with seven seals begin to open. And ultimately, these calamities then lead up to the final redemption. That's the idea anyway. And as John's readers in the first century read these things, they would have interpreted them as current events and recognized them as things from their lifetimes and things from their era, things that they had witnessed in recent years and things that they could anticipate seeing fulfilled in coming days. And they hoped that the calamities that they endured and the distresses and travails that they went through then would quickly culminate with the coming of the Messiah. Well, nearly 2,000 years later, we can still read the unfolding of the tribulation and trials depicted in the book of Revelation as events that lie in store for the future. Yet, simultaneously, as we've learned, it's also possible to see their fulfillment, or their partial fulfillment, if you prefer, in the past, and even in the days of Nero and Domitian, for example. So, from where does this expectation of calamity and judgment before the coming of the Messiah, calamity and divine judgment, come from? It comes from the dark prophecies of the Torah's curses, and the maledictions of the prophets who often warned their readers of divine punishments in store for Israel and in store for the nations, the coming of woes, of sword, of famine, of plague, and death. So, for example, in the book of Amos, it says, "Woe to you who desire the day of the Lord." Why would you have the day of the Lord? It is darkness, not light. As if a man fled from a lion and a bear met him. Or he went into his house, having escaped the danger. He went into his house and leaned his hand against the wall and a serpent bit him. Is not the day of the Lord darkness and not light? Gloom with no brightness in it? In this way, Jewish eschatology contains within it a pessimism about the end times before the arrival of the final redemption. Kind of like the saying, it's always darkest just before dawn, right? Or perhaps every silver cloud has its dark lining. But before we begin popping open the seals and summoning the four horsemen, we do need to do our homework. So let me take you back to Zechariah, the book of Zechariah, so that you can see the background for what we are going to read. Chapter 1, verse 8, Zechariah's vision. The prophet Zechariah says, "I saw in the night, and behold, a man riding on a red horse. He was standing among the myrtle trees in the glen, and behind him were red sorrel and white horses. Then I said, 'What are these, my Lord?' And the angel who talked with me," see, we're getting an apocalyptic vision here. We have an angelic tour guide who's interpreting things for him. "The angel who talked with me said to me, 'I will show you what they are.' So the man who was standing among the myrtle trees answered, 'These are they whom the Lord has sent to patrol the earth.' And they answered the angel of the Lord who was standing among the myrtle trees and said, 'We have patrolled the earth, and behold, all the earth remains at rest.'" So the only thing I need you to take note of here, the only thing I need you to see here is that there is already an idea of four horsemen sent from heaven on a mission to earth. And in this case, their mission is to patrol the earth and then report back to the Almighty the current political situation on earth and to see if the time is ripe for redeeming Zion and rebuilding Jerusalem and reestablishing the temple. That's the question at the beginning of the prophecy of Zechariah. So the four horsemen are reporting, yes, the political climate is favorable to fulfill your promise to reestablish Jerusalem, to reestablish Zion. That's what we're seeing here at the beginning of Zechariah. So the four horsemen, here we have four horsemen riding horses of a different color. Now there is a horse of a different color, right? Couldn't help it. It just occurred to me. According to the Septuagint, you actually have four colors here. I think the Hebrew only gives us three, but the Greek gives us all four. Red, gray, piebald, and white. You know piebald? Don't know piebald? You didn't have a piebald crayon? It's black and white. It's like mottled, speckled, I don't know. It's like black and white. It's like two, okay, it's like a Appaloosa, I think. Okay. Likewise, turn to Zechariah 6. I'll show you another vision of similar character. Zechariah 6, same sort of thing. It says, "Again, I lifted my eyes and saw, and behold, four chariots came out from between two mountains." The mountains were mountains of bronze. "The first chariot had red horses." So this time we get a team of horses. "The second, black horses. The third, white horses. The fourth chariot, dappled horses." Those are your piebald horses. "All of them strong. Then I answered and said to the angel who talked with me, "Who are these, my Lord?" And the angel answered and said to me, "These are going out to the four winds of heaven after presenting themselves before the Lord of all the earth. The chariot with the black horses goes toward the north country. The white ones go after them. The dappled ones go toward the south country. When the strong horses came out, they were impatient to go and patrol the earth." And he said, "Go, patrol the earth." So they patrolled the earth. And then he cried to me, "Behold, those who go toward the north country have set my spirit at rest in the north country." It's another vision. And in this vision, we see four chariots drawn by teams of horses, red, black, white, and dappled. And this time they're going out to the four winds, that is the four directions, which we have learned previously correspond to four of the seven archangels. And again, we see angelic beings who have presented themselves before the Lord of all the earth, which is angel talk, you know, as it says in Job chapter 1, verse 6. It says, "Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord." You know that passage. So this presenting themselves before the Lord establishes, we're talking about angels here. And they go out to set the spirit of the Lord at rest in the north country, which I take to mean bring the Lord's judgment, his just anger, wrath, or retribution upon those lands. The point is that these are angelic beings going out into the earth to do God's will, to carry out God's judgments. And this should establish for us, these visions should establish for us the context to understand what's happening in Revelation chapter 6. So we can go back there to Revelation 6 now, where we have just recently witnessed the worship service of the heavenly temple. A vision of the throne, where the seraphim above the expanse who burn like torches in the presence of the Almighty are chanting, "Holy, holy, holy." And the four living creatures beneath the expanse are glorifying God. And in the midst of this scene, we saw a scroll with seven seals in the right hand of the one who sits upon the throne. And none was found worthy to open the seven seals except for the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Lamb, standing as a lamb who was slain. And he stepped forth and he took the scroll. Remember all of this? He stepped forward and he took the scroll in his hand. And then we start reading in chapter 6, verse 1. It says, "Now I watched when the lamb opened one of the seven seals. And I heard one of the four living creatures, one of the chayot, say with a voice like thunder, 'Come.'" So the sundering of the first seal signals one of these four living creatures, one of these four chayot, to utter a summons, which is kind of interesting that he utters a summons. He summons the first of the four horsemen. He says, "Come." So remember that the four chayot, the four living creatures, represent the created order, the earth, the world below, the world of creation, the world of creatures, whereas the seraphim represent the higher order, the heavens. And so the chayot carry the expanse on their shoulders. They carry the throne, and the throne is above them. So as the lamb sunders the first seal, the first of the four living creatures invites the first horseman to come from the heavenly realm above and enter the lower worlds. And it says in verse 2, "And I looked, and behold, a white horse, and its rider had a bow, and a crown was given to him. And he came out, conquering to conquer." All right, there's a lot of different schools of thought regarding this white horse, a rider on a white horse. Some say that this is King Messiah. This is King Messiah riding out. Because he's riding on a white horse. Who else rides on a white horse? What do you think? It's John Wayne or something? It's got to be the Messiah. He's wearing a crown and he conquers, right? Actually, here's where the idea that this is Messiah comes from, because it seems to correspond directly to the description we read in Revelation 19, where it says, "Then I saw heaven opened, and behold, a white horse. And the one sitting on it is called Faithful and True. And in righteousness, he judges and makes war. This sounds very similar to what we're reading about. His eyes are like a flame of fire, and on his head are many diadems. But this can't be the case, in my opinion. The Messiah in this scene, as we're seeing this scene played out, the Messiah is the Lamb who is opening the scroll by breaking the seals. In other words, he's the one sending the rider. And the fact that the horse is white doesn't really tell us much. The color white doesn't really necessarily denote that this is King Messiah's horse. Because we've already seen in the visions of Zechariah that angels employ white horses. And even in Revelation 19, where the Messiah does come out on a white horse, then the armies of heaven follow him, and guess what they're riding on? White horses. So yeah, God's got a lot of white horses. That's what I'm saying. Nor does the fact that this rider is wearing a crown indicate that this is the Messiah, for the crown worn by the white rider, or the white horseman in Revelation 6 is a Stephanos, a laurel, a victor's wreath. Whereas the crown worn by the Messiah in Revelation 19, these are crowns, they are diadems, they are king's crowns. So I have other reasons too. But another interpretation suggests that, okay, the white rider, it's not the Messiah. It's the gospel message that's going forth to conquer the earth. This one I've heard, and it's sort of attractive. The idea that this represents the gospel going out, conquering. Sort of a church triumphant message, though. But it really doesn't work because it'd be like that Sesame Street, one of these kids is doing his own thing. You know that one Sesame Street thing where it's like, you got like, three kids jumping rope and one kid is like bouncing a ball, and the song goes, one of these kids is doing his own thing, one of these kings is not a kid, you know, one of these kids is not the same, which of these kids is doing his own thing, which of these kids is not the same. So the other three riders are going out to like spread plague and death and destruction, right? The first rider's out passing out tracts. You know? Just not seeing it. And some have surmised that this rider then isn't really such a positive character after all, but that he is the Antichrist. I mean, Messiah rides on a white horse, Antichrist rides on a white horse. False Messiah, lawless one, who comes out to deceive the world, conquering the world, establishing his lawless government. It's just a frightening, kind of chilling thought. But I'm not sure, why should the Messiah send the Antichrist to do his bidding? This also seems troubling to me. It doesn't really follow. Instead, to me, the white rider and all the riders are servants of the Holy One, blessed be He. Each one, I mean, these are terrible servants of the Holy One, blessed be He. I mean, terrifying servants of the Holy One, blessed be He. But each one corresponding to one of the four cherubim who summoned them. You see how there's four angels that are summoning them? Each time one of the four cherubim say, come. This is clearly an angelic type of relationship. And just as there's seven trumpets and seven bowls and seven seals corresponding to seven archangels, likewise we have four riders with a direct correspondence to the four chayot, the four cherubim, the four living creatures beneath the throne of glory. So we understand that the white rider, he's not the Messiah, he's not the false Messiah, neither is it the gospel message. Rather, the white rider that rides forth with a bow for shooting arrows and conquering to conquer, this white rider, this angel, is the spirit. I would suggest to you, it's the spirit of conquest that he goes forth conquering to conquer. He's a spirit of conquest. He's a spirit that inspires the desire for conquest, the lust of kings. He is the spirit of empire, the spirit of Alexanders, of Caesars, of Khans, of Napoleons. And in the days of the apostles, he was manifest in the conquests of the Roman Empire, always hungry for more, always pressing their boundaries, always looking to dominate, to subjugate. And the spirit of conquest came to the land of Israel in the days of the apostles when the legions of Nero and Vespasian and Titus marched on the Galilee and on Jerusalem. And the spirit of conquest rode forth. You know, just pick an era, pick a century. When didn't the spirit of conquest ride forth? The spirit of conquest rode forth in the days of Napoleon. He rode forth in the days of the British Empire. He rode forth in the days of the Nazi Reich, in the days of the USSR and the People's Republic. And today he prepares to ride again as the first seal is broken. I can't tell you if the seal has already been broken or it's yet to be broken. If we're looking at the past from our perspective, or if we're seeing a vision of this rider in the past or the present or the future, I don't know any of that, but I can only tell you that we have not yet seen the final ride of the rider on the white horse. I'm convinced of that. And so it says in verse 3, when he opened the second seal, I heard the second living creature say, "Come." And out came another horse, bright red. Its rider was permitted. This is a divine permitted by God, permitted, given authority, permitted by God to take peace from the earth so that people should slay one another. And he was given a great sword. So in the wake of the spirit of conquest, what comes after the spirit of conquest has moved through the earth? War. Conquest breeds war. It brings war. Violence, a red horse for the color of spilled blood, its rider permitted by God to take peace from the earth. You know, what was in the days of the apostles? Pax Romana, the great peace of Rome, held things down throughout the empire. This rider is given the permission to break the Pax Romana. He's given a great sword with which to execute violence, inciting the people on earth to slay one another. This is the spirit of war, the spirit of violence. And you know, we know, he's ridden through the earth many times before, and in the days of the apostles, we saw his work in the spilling of blood, not only the blood of the martyrs, which the book of Revelation is concerned with, but also the blood of fratricide, of Jew against Jew in the first and second Jewish revolts, a time when blood ran in apocalyptic rivers. And while the Romans were laying siege to Jerusalem, I don't know if you realize this, but at that same time, while the Romans were laying siege to Jerusalem, you know what was happening back in Italy after the death of Nero? Rome went to war with Rome. And it was legion against legion marching against each other. And the streets of Rome ran red with blood of fratricide, just like the streets of Jerusalem were running red. This is the work of the rider on the red horse, an angelic spirit of judgment which unleashes the worst in man and turns one against another. And his bloody hoof prints have stamped their way through human history. But never more dramatically, I think, than the carnage stomped beneath the red horse's hooves during the 20th century. The dead of World War I and World War II, and not just the civilians or the soldiers, but the civilians, and the dead of all the bloody revolutions and uprisings from the 20th century, and all the forced imposed famines of the 20th century. They're piled to heaven. So I don't know. I think this rider's been at work. It says in verse 5, and when he opened the third seal, I heard the third living creature say, "Come." And I looked, and behold, a black horse. And its rider had a pair of scales in its hands, you know, a pair of balances, these balances, balancing scales. The black horse rides forth. This is a spirit of famine. Famine follows war and violence. The horse is black to depict starvation, the blackening of the skin, the darkness of despair. And he carries with him this pair of balance scales symbolizing rationing. What happens in a time of famine? Food rationing. As it says in the Torah, it says, this is one of the curses, it says, when I break your supply of bread, your staff of bread, 10 women shall bake your bread in a single oven. This one oven's going to be plenty large for 10 to use because they have so little to bake. And they shall dole out your bread by weight, in other words, by scales. And you shall eat and not be satisfied. It's Leviticus 26:26. So the black horse of famine has these scales with which to dole out the rations. And you know this black rider has ridden many times through the earth, and in the days of the apostles, we know that the famine, the siege famine in Israel and in the land of Israel and in Jerusalem killed more Jews in the Jewish revolt than the Romans did. Thousands. Josephus describes how when the Romans entered Jerusalem, they finally burst into the upper city, and they finally got into the upper city, and they burst into the homes. Everyone was already dead from the famine. The apostolic community would know these stories. They lived through this. As it says in the Torah, they shall besiege you in your towns until your high fortified walls in which you trusted come down throughout the land, and they shall besiege you in your towns throughout your land. And you shall eat the fruit of your womb, the flesh of your sons and daughters, in the siege and in the distress which your enemies shall bring upon you. So in this regard, the black rider, the rider on the black horse, fulfilled his mission, because judgment begins with the house of God in the days of the apostles, and he's done his work, as we know, in various places, in every generation, and especially in the 20th century. World populations, you know, the world populations, there's just like so much more potential for famine with the world populations at these numbers. And he waits to ride again at an appointed time when the third seal is broken. As it says in verse 6, and I heard what seemed to be a voice in the midst of the four living creatures saying, a quart of wheat for a denarius, 3 quarts of wheat for a denarius, but do not harm the oil and wine. So a denarius is a day's wages. I don't know what you think of, what's a day's wages? I was thinking, okay, you know, let's just say, I mean, just round figure, $100. It's a day's wages. It's $100. A quart of wheat for $100. 3 quarts of barley for $100. So, you know, enough to feed your family one day, $100. Enough to feed your horse one day, $100. The point is that food scarcity has driven the prices up to 8 times the normal price for wheat, 5 times the normal price for barley. So why does the heavenly voice prevent the angelic spirit of famine from harming the oil and the wine then? That's the real question here. I mean, that's kind of the intriguing thing. But don't touch the oil and the wine. Why? What's the deal? Well, oil refers to olive trees. Wine refers to vineyards, whereas wheat and barley refer to cereal crops. So the implication is that the famine, the severe famine, is not a long-term famine. It's not like a famine in the days of Joseph that lasts, you know, 7 years. It affects the year's crops, decimating the food supply, but the angel does not damage the olive trees in the vineyards because they would take 10 years to replace. And the famine is not to endure that long. We know that we're on the edge of the Messianic era when this rider goes forth. And in the Messianic era, there's going to be an abundance of new wine and oil, the prophets say. So the words, don't damage the oil and the wine, because we still need to fulfill the prophecies of the Messianic era. So it says in verse 7, when he opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth living creature say, come. And I looked, and behold, a pale horse. And its rider's name was Death and Hades, or Death, and Hades followed him. And they were given authority over a fourth of the earth to kill with the sword, with famine, with pestilence, and by wild beasts of the earth. Now, Death and Hades, we've already been introduced. Do you remember back at the beginning of the whole deal, back in Revelation chapter 1, where it said, our master says to John on the island of Patmos, he says, fear not. I am the first and the last and the living one. I died, and behold, I am alive forevermore, and I have the keys to death and Hades. So he has the keys to death and Hades. He holds the keys to death and Hades, means he also holds the authority over them. So death rides forth on a pale horse. Actually, a better translation, a sickly green horse. A green horse. A horse of green pallor. The pallor of death. And he follows conquest and war and famine. And death rides forth with his associate, like the Lone Ranger and Tonto. Death rides forth with his associate Sheol, that is, the grave and the place of the dead. They ride out hungry and eager because God has given them authority to devour a fourth of the world's population, those slain with the sword. And with famine, and with pestilence, and it says, and by the wild beasts, which reminds us of the plagues of Passover we were learning last week. And it also reminds us of what it says in Ezekiel chapter 5, when Ezekiel is warning about the destruction to come upon Judah by the hand of the Babylonians. He says, you shall be a reproach and a taunt, a warning and a horror, when I execute judgments on you in anger and fury and with furious rebukes, when I send against you the deadly arrows of famine, arrows for destruction, and when I bring more and more famine upon you and break your supply of bread, and I will send famine and wild beasts, and pestilence and blood shall pass through you, and I will bring the sword upon you. So we've seen all of these elements from Ezekiel 5. All of these have shown up in Revelation 6. This is the judgment of God. And our brothers and sisters that were reading the book of Revelation as John sent this prophecy, this apocalypse, this vision out to our brothers and sisters in the late first century, back in the mid-90s, they had already witnessed death and Hades gorging themselves on the Jewish people of the land of Israel and throughout the empire. And they were only a generation away from another bitter stroke, the generation that would see the Bar Kokhba War. And what generation hasn't seen death and Hades rampaging? I mean, I'm sort of a history guy, you know, and it gives you sort of this sober vision of not just the apocalypse of the future, but all the apocalypses of the past in every generation. We've seen plenty of death and Hades rampaging. But rarely have we ever seen it in such dramatic fury as the death toll of the 20th century in war and murder and famine and pestilence as they made their way through the earth. So now death waits to ride out again over the earth, if we are understanding this correctly, at the time of the sundering of the fourth seal. And I believe that we are living in the days of the birth pangs of Messiah. But should we then live in fear? I mean, really, haven't these horsemen always been doing their work in the earth? They really aren't bringing anything new to the picture. As our master says, these are the words of Yeshua, "You will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See to it that you are not alarmed. For this must take place, but the end is not yet. Nation will rise against nation. Kingdom will rise against kingdom. There will be famines and earthquakes in various places, but these are only the beginning of the birth pains." So according to our master, the birth pains began in the days of the apostles when they saw these things happening around them. And how many times since then have the four riders been riding their paths of devastation through the earth? And even now, even today, we don't need to be afraid when we see these things. We don't need to store up, you know, build bunkers, hoard weapons, store up freeze-dried goods. We don't need to live in fear. Because our master says, when these things begin to take place, here's what you're supposed to do. When you see these things taking place, straighten up and raise your heads, because your redemption is drawing near.
Take on my yoke and learn from me and find rest for your soul.